Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawai and Scott Wigand, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We are joined today by Professor Jose Arriata from the Chicano Studies Department at Los Angeles Valley College. Thank you so much for joining us, Jose.
Well, first of all, I'm glad to be at Valley College. I remember many moons ago, I wanted to come to school there, or actually attend school at Valley College, but life ended up changing. So I went to another community college. But just kind of backtracking, my educational experience is pretty unique, I feel, because in my household, like many brown households, they focus on work, and sometimes school gets pushed in the back burner. Not that it's intentional, but it happens, you know. Especially coming from a family that's low income, I would say we were below poverty line. There was four of us that lived in a studio. So it was pretty difficult. My mom was a seamstress, not only in Mexico, but in the United States. So she worked like pretty late hours. She was seldom at home. So that kind of impacted my early educational experiences. But in elementary, I was very fortunate to my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Castro was her name, which is interesting. And she was from Cuba. She said she had known Fidel Castro. But one thing about her that I appreciated my early years in education, my early educational experience was her believing in me, because many of the brown kids that were going to school, many of us, you know, we didn't see the benefit of going to school, even in elementary. Nobody told us that brown people could be successful in school, maybe become a lawyer, a doctor, even a police officer, per se. And she was very inspirational. She would share stories how it was difficult in her country. And when she came to the United States, her and her family were able to adapt to the new environment, learn English, and basically assimilated into American society. And I've always remembered her stories, because as a young child, I was also an immigrant. I came to the U.S. at the age of three or four. And as a young kid, I had to adapt quickly to the new language and the new environment. And I was fortunate enough to learn English pretty quite fast. And part of the reason was through bad words, unfortunately. I was hearing a lot of kids in the neighborhood would say bad words, so on and so forth. And I would ask, what does that mean? What does that mean? So I say by the second and third grade, I was pretty good at English. But then before I had met Mrs. Castro, I was pretty upset at the educational system, because they automatically threw me in ESL classes. And I was very upset because I noticed that I was being placed at the back of the classroom while other kids that were also brown were at the front of the classrooms. And I would ask, why am I in the back? And they said, oh, because you're ESL student. And I'm like, well, I speak perfect English, but I was pretty adaptable with my English, that I was always the example. Look, what they would call me Joy, by the way, even though my name was Jose. So that was another issue, going home and telling my mom that my new name was Joy. She was not too fond of that. But they would always use me as
No, so I remember one of the coaching lessons we had, my kids went to this very intense preschool where the teacher just said, you know what, your kids are ready for school. Like, this was a very intense preschool and kindergarten. So do not admit to the schools that you were not born in the U.S. because it's just an automatic placement thing. And once they label you ESL, it is hard to get you off that track, regardless of what your test scores are.
Well, I found out that the issue I was placed in ESL was because of my last name, and that was a standard protocol for many of the brown kids. And then later on, when I went through my educational experience, I noticed that was a standard protocol. My brother was born in the U.S., so was my sister, and they still forced them to take ESL because of their last name. And then I inquired a bit more, and I found out that if ever you fill out the school's form for the native language, if you state that you're bilingual, they automatically place you in ESL, unfortunately. So I always tell many of my students that when you go through this experience and you have a brown last name, always say that you only speak English in order for your kids not to be typecast as immigrants, per se.
Wow. Jose, when you were going to school and when you started with elementary, what area were you in? Were you in the San Fernando Valley or Los Angeles? Or
no, I was in L.A. I was in Huntington Park, to be more exact. It was the education there was okay. I had some great teachers that were very kind and loving, I would say. And they would try to instill good things in many of us students, trying to motivate us to go to school. But again, it was pretty difficult to have a teacher telling you the school is the way to go when at home the message was a little bit different, kind of gearing you to become employed. To the extent that when I was in the fifth grade, I started working as It's a big chain, a supermarket now. It's called a Superior, but back in the days, it was a small market. I would, you know, kind of clean the floors, clean the counters and stuff like that. So at an early age, I understood that my household, work meant more than actually going to school, unfortunately.
Were you the oldest in your family as far as children?
I'm the oldest. I'm the only one that my mom and my dad had. And from my dad's side, I have five brothers. From my mom's side, I have two sisters and a brother. But I'm the only one. I'm the eldest of the whole bunch. You had a question, John?
What age were you?
Like 9 years old, around there, 9, 8 years old. Still a little kid. I mean, I would shelf all the potato chips, as I recall, you know, and they would make me run errands for them. Like the store owner would tell me to go, well, actually send me to his house to go take groceries to his wife and stuff like that. They would pay me like 50 cents or a buck per se. But then after a period of time, they would pay me like maybe a week. I was fortunate enough to make 20 bucks. And they would also make me go up and down Pacific Boulevard, passing out flyers for their market, as I recall. And then I got pretty savvy. I felt exploited that they would give me a big old bunch of flyers to hand out to people that I ended up, you know, unfortunately throwing some in the trash can to make it seem that I was working a little bit hard. But early on, I began to understand the significance of a child exploitation, unfortunately, and I was not too fond of that. Whether doing that per se or even moving forward, I never forget when they would pick us up in a van and go to different communities to go sell chocolates. And for every box that we would sell, each box was like $5. You would be fortunate enough to get a dollar off that. So by the end of the day, you might work 5-6 hours. You would be fortunate to maybe make $10. So I understood that through those particular exploitations as a child, I really didn't, I didn't see the benefit of basically going to work. I understood or started to seek a different path than basically working these little minimal jobs as a child. But yet again, they paid me minimal. But I understood that there was much exploitation that was going on at the time. As a young kid, working various odd jobs and being paid like 50 cents to a buck now and then weekly making like $10, I realized that people were out to exploit me or my labor, I should say, not only in regards to working at a supermarket, whether stocking or shelving some of the stuff or passing out flyers, and then later on working for these little agencies that would post ads on street signs stating that if you want to work for the summer, come work for us. You can make like a pretty good money. And while I was selling candy, the candy boxes were like at least $5, and you would get a dollar for each box that you would sell. And maybe working 4 to 5 hours that particular. And by the way, there were evening shifts. They would pick us up like around 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, and we would work till 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock sometimes. So I would get home, and I was underage, by the way. I was not even 12 years old. I was still a young kid, but they didn't mind picking me up and using me as a ploy to get people to sell chocolates. But I realized that was not the path that I wanted to go.
And in school while you're doing this, I can't imagine you being able to spend too much time on homework or anything like that.
Well, again, unfortunately, my mom, again, was worked in the seamstress, the maquila industry, as they call it in Mexico. And she would work different odd hours. Sometimes she would have to work double shifts. She would work during the day and at night. So she was obviously most of the time not home. So I became a parent of the household, I would say, at the age of 9, where I had to take care of my brother and sister at the time. My other younger sister wasn't born yet. But I had to take care of them. I had to wipe their behinds. I had to make sure that they ate and all that stuff. So at a young age, I realized and understood to be responsible, unfortunately. And it's not that it was my mom's fault per se, but it was just the economic situation that we were living in, that she was making all these sacrifices to go to work in order for us to have at least a roof under our heads and food to eat for that particular time. But after a while, you know, I would say that like many brown homes, sometimes we go through some difficulties. I had to deal with domestic violence at home from my stepdad. So I say by the age of 10, I decided to liberate myself. I was used to being independent. So I began to live on the streets, and while living in the streets, in Huntington Park specifically, I'll never forget. I would pump gas, I would wash windows, I would get a quarter, 50 cents or so, and I would spend most of my time kind of deviating from the reality that I had nowhere to go. And I would play video games, and video games became my outlet, as I would say, where I was able to escape from the reality that I lived in, and basically, you know, try to forget about going home. So again, my mom not being at home, having to work multiple jobs, and then having my stepdad at home and he didn't see me as a son kind of made the situation pretty difficult. That, like I said, at the age of 10, I decided to liberate myself and run away. And the first night of living on the streets was pretty unique for me, I would say, because one of my friends, Peter, was chasing me, telling me that your stepdad wants you to go home. I was like, hey, no, I'm not going home. I knew what awaited me if I went home. So I decided to run away, and I'll never forget. Now it's by Spartan Burgers in Huntington Park. It's actually on Florence Boulevard. I forgot the other cross street. But there used to be a liquor store there. And at the end of the liquor store, like an alleyway, there was four homeless men and one homeless woman. They saw me crying as a young kid, and they asked me, hey, what's wrong? And I just decided to open up. I told them what difficulties I had to endure at home. And the lady was very compassionate, and they decided, I'll never forget, they mustered up. They were drunk as all get out. They were really tipsy, like we say in the neighborhood, but they mustered up their spare change, and they decided to buy me, I'll never forget, some M&Ms, the peanut M&Ms, by the way. They weren't the cheap generic all chocolate ones. And they bought me a Coca-Cola. And by doing that, they started to talk to me, and I'll never forget what the lady said and those men that were there. They said, I shared my story with them, and they were very supportive. They said, look, in Spanish, look, mijo, we've been through a lot of stuff ourselves too, and we know that you're going to one day amount to something, and you would have potential in your life. And but don't worry, what you have to go through, we had to deal with similar stuff like that, and we don't want you to end up like us. So by them sharing that story with me, it was very inspirational to see people that I didn't know, had no business in my life, decided to at least inspire me to not look into the difficulties that I had to endure at the moment, but transition into looking into the future with the hopes that things would be ultimately better. But living in the streets was pretty unique. Even to this particular day, you could catch me with some shorts, you know, and you could tell me, hey, it's cold outside. And I would tell you, no, not really. I adapted to the cold environment pretty easily, I would say. I would sleep in dog houses and rooftops under cars sometimes, but I stopped sleeping under cars quickly because sometimes people didn't know you were under the car. And when you hear the car start, you better get your butt out of there real quick. So it was, I love the way that I grew up because it helped me to not only survive, but ultimately, you know, figure out ways that to connect with people and to look for people that really want the best for you, regardless whether they know you or not. And that was very, very beneficial. But this was my routine. So I would sleep in the streets, and then I already knew I had my cheapo little watch that I would carry with me. And I would already know exactly what time it was to go to school. I was always getting up by 5:30, 5 o'clock. So I would walk to school, and when I would get to school, I would eat breakfast in the cafeteria. I didn't have my lunch tickets with me. So the lady, I would tell her that I left them at home, and she was very nice enough. Or sometimes even other classmates would give me their breakfast or their lunch tickets, and I would eat there. Once school was over, I would go back to the streets. I wouldn't even stop by the house. Or again, my mom wouldn't know whether I was there in and out, by the way, because the times that she would work. So I would be on the street most of the time. I would, like I said, I would pump gas. I would wash windows. And whatever money I would get from there, I would buy me some chips, or if possible, I would try to give me a burger from Spartan Burgers or some French fries and stuff like that. So I was able to sustain myself by basically washing windows and pumping gas at neighborhood gas stations. I'll never forget that one man, I told him, I'm hungry. Can I pump your gas? And he goes, no. And I go, okay, thank you. And I was never rude or anything like that. And he goes, come with me. So there was a neighborhood lunch truck right there. And he goes, you hungry? And I go, yeah, I'm hungry. He goes, get whatever you want. I looked at him like, are you sure? I was like maybe 12 at the time, and I never forget. I got me 10 tacos, and not only 10 tacos, I got me two sodas and a burrito. And that man saw me eat all that stuff in one load, and he was pretty amazed that I ended up eating all that food without even, hesitating. I was probably like a little eating machine, I would say. I ate a lot that day. But it was a good experience, though, even though I know it sounds difficult as a young child living on the streets, but at the end of the day, I was fortunate enough that I didn't get into any trouble per se, and I was able to survive. But my teachers never knew what was going on. They knew that I wore the same clothes, and you know, life went on, like they would say.
How long did this go on for?
It went on from the first time I took off, I was in the second grade. I was like maybe 8 years old. So I went on from the third grade all the way to the sixth grade for the time that I lived in Huntington Park. But then when we moved to the Northeast District of LA, Montecito Heights specifically, it still went on from junior high school and high school.
So you were always based around where your parents were because you needed their address for school?
In a sense. Yeah, in a sense. It was like that, but I didn't know anywhere else to go. So it was basically my benefit would be situated around the area that I knew best.
And then what happened in junior high school?
Oh, that's when I realized that school was not for me. I went to John Muir Junior High in South Central. I was one of those kids that was bused in the magnet program. They told me it was the best thing for me. It was actually to create diversity in that community, which I didn't know at the time, but it was very difficult. The reason being there was rapid violence. It was just that we would be playing maybe during nutrition or lunch or during PE hours, and there would be cars that would roll through and basically do a drive-by, as it would say. So we had a standard protocol at the school that whenever you hear the deans or people that worked on campus to drop, you had to drop in a put your stomach on the ground and then don't get up until they tell you to get up, because violence was pretty rampant. And not only that, there was racial tensions going on. I went to school during the LA riots, so a lot of the African-American students were trying to beat up on the brown kids, and I was one of those kids that was being bullied, but I fought back. Not that it was a racial thing, but they hit me. I'll let you hit me once. They hit me twice, then basically it became a reason for me to defend myself. And after that, they never really messed with me, but I had to endure not only the shooting that would go on there, but also some of the racial tensions that the kids would exhibit, unfortunately. So, and not only, and here's the other factor that didn't make school a suitable thing for me, was teachers didn't care. Many of the teachers were just reading their newspaper. They would just throw a video up there, and they wouldn't even share nothing regarding, to try to inspire you to become successful in life. Actually, let me backtrack. There was one teacher, Mrs. McCarthy, African-American teacher that taught literature. She was a big blessing in my life, because I'll never forget. She said, look, you see all this? And we were like, what are you talking about, Mrs.? What are you talking about? She said, look, all these things that you see here are called certificates. Well, they're called diplomas. And we were asking her, what do you mean? What are diplomas? She says, every time you graduate from somewhere, you get a diploma. And she had 3 master's and 2 PhD degrees. And she was very adamant to share her experience growing up in the 50s and 60s, how going to school was very difficult for her, but she was able to find a way to become successful. And she would always share with us that we were very fortunate to have a person like her in the classroom. And in a sense, that is true. She was the only one that actually played a role in my life later on in realizing that, she was able to accomplish so many things that maybe I could do it myself as well. And in high school, it was the same old thing. Gang violence, whenever it was difficult walking to and from school, because you had to go through different neighborhoods that they would wait for you. They would try to jump you. So I was pretty good at running fast. And, we lived in high alert. I call it post-traumatic stress disorder. Whenever you walk through a different neighborhood where you see a bunch of different guys that you didn't know, you better start running. Whether you were affiliated or not, that was kind of the standard protocol. But I could say that my senior year, I got pretty smart. I decided to get me a little bike, and I started riding the bike to and from school, even though I was sweaty when I got there, but I could care less as long as I knew I made it to school. But high school wasn't any different, I would say, other than just, hanging out, people not really caring about school. So school was not really something that was being promoted at Franklin High School in my particular environment of students that we were in. That doesn't mean that others weren't pushed for a higher education. In high school, it was I just slept in the garage. So it didn't, we were fortunate to have a garage where we lived at. So they didn't know whether I was there or not. I was basically like a mouse. You would just know that I was there by proof of rat droppings, I guess, to some extent. But I was always independent. But I couldn't really be independent, I would say, especially during those many years, because I always had to go back and check on my brothers and sisters, and my brother and sister, I should say, at the time, and make sure that everything was all right with them. Even when they would see me at school, and they would tell my mom that I would go to school. So I guess at the end of the day, that's all that mattered. That I, in a sense, that my mom knew I was still going to school one way or another. I'll just tell you the truth. Like many of the kids that grew up in my particular neighborhood, for example, if you hit 18, that's you lived a good life. So after 18, nothing was expected. And then when 18 hit, I was like, hey, I'm not dead yet. I mean, I've been shot at before just by walking down the street, just people wanting to have fun and stuff like that. They wanted to, I guess, earn their stripes. So I learned early on that whenever you walked up and down Figueroa Boulevard, whether it be going through Montecito Heights, Cypress Park, or even Highland Park, I always carried a Bible with me. And by opening up the little Bible, when the gang members would see me, they would kind of let me be. They wouldn't mess with me. They would assume that I was a religious person. But I guess I was, to that extent, praying to God that nothing came about.
How did you do at school?
First, I was very upset. I did most of my work. But when I graduated and with everyone, they told me, sorry, we can't give you your diploma because you're 10 credits short. I was like, how in the world am I 10 credits short? So I had to go back to school for that particular summer. And then once I finished the summer, they told me, oh, we're sorry, you're 30, you're now you're 20 units over. And I was like, what do you mean I'm 20 units over? They just basically sent me back to school for no reason. And that created a lot of animosity in my heart, because I tried to do whatever I had to do, in order to get my high school degree. And they had robbed me, and they embarrassed me by forcing me to go back to school for half a semester. That I wasn't having none of that, and nothing in particular, nothing to do with school in particular. But at the age of 18, once school was all said and done, I went with one of my friends. His name is Carlos. I used to stay with him now and then. He wanted to go to Pasadena Community College. I decided to go with him just to go see him enroll. And I felt comfortable that he was able to, I knew that he was a troublemaker. You know, sometimes we were doing hanging out, messing around or whatever. So I knew that I knew his background, so I didn't see him as a person that was always into education. And I saw that he was going to, or basically enrolling into a school at Pasadena Community College. So that kind of, in a sense, you know, planted a seed that maybe I should go to school later on. But I didn't. I worked for 2 years, construction, plumbing. I would get paid pretty well, by the way. The hours were very difficult and long. And I realized, again, I started to see the exploitation factor and began to feel it, I should say, that I decided to quit my work and do something else. And that something else was going to school. So I went back to school close to the age of 20. So I spent basically like a year and a half in just working, again, plumbing and construction, making good money. I quit that, went back to school. My first year in school, it was a summer session. I took a whopping one unit, PE. I failed. I got an F. I don't know how that happened, but I got an F in PE. I guess it was not about personal workout. You had to follow whatever guidelines they had for you or reps. But I had a little bit of difficulty, but I still was trying to figure out a way to pursue school. So I kept on fighting. After being in academic probation twice with a whopping GPA of 0.9, I was about to get kicked out. They told me for the last time. And one of the counselors told me, you need to take this introduction to college class, something of that sort. And I said, okay, if you don't take this class, you can't take no more classes here. And I was upset because I began to love going to school, because I would take classes that I found interesting, whether it be philosophy, whether it be PE classes, whether it be art classes. I just began to take all kinds of stuff that was not even centered towards GE. I didn't know none of that stuff, but I knew that taking these classes were a benefit for me as a person, whether psychology again or child development. So I took all these different courses. And when the counselor told me that my 0.9 basically equated to me not to even further my education unless I do something about it, I decided to stop making excuses. I realized I had no money. I realized I had no financial aid. I realized I had no home support to go to school. I realized I had no books. I realized I had no method of transportation. So I stopped making excuses. I began to ride the bike to school. When the buses went on strike, then again, it was taking the bike. I had to get up early in the morning in order to ride and get to school all sweaty, stinky, smelly. I would, if I was fortunate enough, and I was blessed that I was working at a private school, teaching PE for the young kids at the age of 20, coaching them, whether basketball or baseball or football. And they would pay me $10 a day just to have PE with the kids. So those $10 were very vital to my livelihood. I would use those $10 to feed myself. And my standard protocol was, since I would go to school 5 days out of the week, I would spend $2.50 in order to buy me something to eat. And Carl's Jr. was the best thing that ever happened to me. I would get myself two spicy chicken sandwiches that they had, and I would make them last. And that was my usual meal. And I would have my bottle of water that I would get. So I was figuring out ways to sustain myself in going to school. But then once in school, the things that I began to utilize was proper usage of my time, whether it be designating time to do my homework, or whether it be asking other fellow classmates to let me borrow their book, or again, there was no cell phones where you could take a screenshot of it and save it for later. Technology wasn't so advanced back then. So I would have asked them if I could scan their books. I began to ask instructors, what books are you going to use before the semester started in order to check them out from the library? Or I would go to other libraries to try to check out the course text. And I began to utilize school resources like the tutoring service, for example, the counseling service as another example. I just began to plug myself into a lot of the resources in the school. And these resources were vital because they helped sustain me in school. And like I tell many students, my educational experience at Pasadena Community College is not one that was easy or pleasant. I graduated with a 2.2 GPA. It took me 4 years to graduate from there. And I graduated with a whopping 120 units, which is double the coursework. But again, part of that reason was because I was taking classes that I found interesting at that particular time. But once I graduated from Pasadena, well, the blessing of Pasadena Community College was my Chicano studies instructor, by the way, Dr. Orozco. I was taking his class and I was trying hard to figure out exactly how to write an essay, do different stuff like how to do citation, how to read a book properly, how to look for particular answers to a question. One day he returned my midterm to me and he pulled me to the side and he told me, Jose, this is not college level material. And that was heartbreaking to hear it from a brown person that looked like me, who I really looked up to. But I didn't, even though it was heartbreaking, and at the end of the semester, I thought I was going to get an F or a D. I got a C. That C was the biggest thing that ever happened to me. That helped me understand that even though I had these difficulties that I still need to not only conquer, in a say, but kind of deal with, like my lack of educational experiences in regards to writing and doing math and all that stuff. But him giving me that C kind of inspired me to understand that he saw some potential in me. And when he gave me that C, that was the worst thing that would ever had happened to somebody else, I would say, because that C could have crushed somebody, but that C was the most inspirational thing that occurred to me that really pushed me forward to seek my education to the utmost. And he, since I got my AA at Pasadena Community College, even to this particular day, over 20 years later, he's still my mentor. I consider him like a father figure, and he's been, I say, without him, I would not be where I am today, because he was very, again, inspirational, motivational, but he became like a supplemental father figure, mentor that I never had in the past that really inspired me to do better for myself. So from Pasadena Community College, I went to Cal State LA. I got my BA there. It took me 2.5 years to get my education there. And then I got married. I got married at the age of 24 with my wife. So our responsibilities had changed, and I I had a unique schedule for 2 years, I would say. My schedule was I would go to school from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock or 1:30, I should say, and then go coach at the private school from 1:30 to 3 o'clock. And then from 4 to 6 o'clock, I would work at different days at the local recreation center. And then in the evenings, I would have to work graveyard shift for FedEx from 11 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning. I would get home like at 4:30, 4:45. Go to sleep for 3.5 hours if possible. I just did that routine for 2 years, but I had to do it because I was newly married. I had a family to take care of, but I still found a way to go to school. So it took me 2.5 years to get my BA in Chicano studies. And I graduated with a 2.75, which was pretty impressive comparing the fact that I went from a 0.9 to 2.2. Now it was a 2.7.5. And there was an issue though. I wanted to go to the master's program, but unfortunately, my GPA did not merit me going to the master's program because you needed to have a 3.0. So I talked to a couple of my instructors, Dr. Valderrama and Dr. Cantu. They're long retired, but I told them, look, you've seen my progress over a period of time. I really want to be part of the master's program. I know I would excel. Can you please vouch for me? And they did. They led me in the master's program. It took me 2.5 years to get my first master's in Chicano studies. And my GPA was a 3.86. I only got one B plus, and that was because that instructor told me that I have to learn a lesson. And the lesson is that you're not going to just graduate from our program getting all A pluses or all A's. You're going to have to get a B in it because it doesn't make us look good. I was like, okay. So if you look at my transcripts, I only got one B, and that was because of that particular instructor. But that's okay. Graduated from there, got my master's, and then shortly after I graduated, I was very fortunate enough that I was able to find employment at other colleges, whether going back to my alma mater, Pasadena Community College. I've also taught at El Camino Community College. I taught at Santiago Canyon College. I taught at Cal State Dominguez Hills, and also obviously at Valley and Mission Hills. I wanted to be, once I started coaching, like I ended up coaching at that private school for 10 years. I coached at Lincoln High School, the junior and varsity team. I've even coached, I was getting paid by the LA Clippers. They have a specific team called the Clipper Chairman, looking at disabled body people that were playing play basketball on wheelchairs. I did that for 2 years. We lost a championship twice, though, but at least we got there. But working with those particular people and those in various dynamics, whether high school, junior high school, or disabled body people, really inspired me to become a teacher. And I've always been a teacher at heart. I started coaching when I was 16 at the local recreation center. So I've always invested in other kids. And I think part of the reason was because nobody really invested in me early on, except for those little small instances that I decided to really, I saw the need in my community. Many of the kids that were lacked a father figure, not that I wanted to be that, but I wanted to be a role model for them. And I was very fortunate enough to be a role model to the extent that over 40 kids from my community I'm glad to say went to college. Some of them went, got their AA. Some of them got their BAs and MAs. I'm still waiting for a PhD to come out of the batch. But I'm very fortunate to be a part of their life. But my goal was to become a high school teacher. But once I went to PCC, Community College at Pasadena, Dr. Orozco inspired me to become an instructor in Chicano studies. He said I would do, according to him, I would do a better job and better justice serving my community in the educational realm and trying to inspire more people to further their education.
Let me ask you this. So what were some of the things that you were talking about your professor who mentored you and was like a father figure to you? Like, how did you develop that relationship? And what were some of the things that happened between the two of you that sort of created such a deep bond?
He was mad. He would always shut me up, by the way, because I was an osicón. I was a loudmouth in the classroom. I would always raise my hand and ask a question. I asked a question about this. What do you mean the Aztecs did this and this and that? What do you mean the Maya this and that? What do you mean the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo? So I was very interested in my culture, my history, that he would begin to give me examples of the many issues that my community had to endure in order to coexist in the United States. So he would, after one day after class, he tells me, you know what? You're an Osicón. Sometimes you got to wait till we get to that chapter. Don't be asking questions when we're not there yet. And I go, so you don't want me to ask questions no more? He goes, no, I want you to ask questions, but wait till we get to that particular week or that particular reading. And he goes, but you know, I like your osico. I like your loudmouth. You should go to school. I think it'll be good for you. And he was very influential, not only in regards to telling me to go to school, but in many instances when I was economically, I know he wouldn't want me to say this, but economically hurting, he became my financial aid to further my education. I paid him back, but I don't think I paid him more than enough. And the way I see it, you know, I'm a religious person per se. And I feel that in my own context, that it was God protecting me ever since a little kid, that he ended up kind of realizing all the nonsense that I had to deal with and blessed me with this particular man who really became not only a father figure, an inspiration figure as well, but somebody that really grounded me to become successful and to seek higher education as a means to better myself, the people in my community, and my family as well.
Wow. I mean, this is just such an amazing story. So when did you come to Valley College, and sort of what has been your experience with our college?
Well, when I was I was 18 at the time, I had just graduated. My friend Carlos, again, had registered to Pasadena Community College. One of my friends, he works for the mayor now, mayor's office, Cesar Avalos. He tells me, hey, you should enroll in school. I'm staying over here by the Valley. Do you want to register to school at Valley College? And I said, all right. We took the bus. That was the longest experience ever. It took It took 2 hours to get to school from LA, catching all these buses. Once we get there, guess what? The campus is closed. There was no opportunity for me to register to school. So that became a closed door to go to Valley College. And I was fortunate enough to actually go to Pasadena Community College because it was a lot closer to my house. So instead of making it a 2-hour journey, it ended up being like an hour journey instead. So it's interesting how early on in my educational journey, I sought Valley College as a means to further my education there. It didn't pan out, but it come full circle, I'm back in Valley.
When did you start in your role as a professor?
I became an adjunct in 2009, and I became a full-timer 2 years ago. So I've been there for a good while.
So how has the experience been different now that you're on the tenure track? How's your experience been different now that you have a lot more security with the school?
The saddest thing is that before I became tenure, many of the schools that I would actually work, again, going back to my issue of working, I guess, I would work at, early in the morning, I would go to work at El Camino Community College. I would leave my home at 6 o'clock. I would work there till like 11 o'clock, and then I would have to drive to Santiago Canyon College in Orange County, and I would have to be there at 12:45 till like almost 2 o'clock, and then sometimes, depending on the schedule, I would have to drive all the way to Valley, so that became my regular routine. But unfortunately, many of the campuses that I worked with were very sad to see me go. And part of the reason is because I would help them out and work in various departments, whether it be working with Puente, working with Mencha. I was always there, eager and willing to help out, regardless if it meant teaching a class late night or whatever they needed from me. I was always there for them. But yet again, I was kind of planting seeds in different campuses. And I never had the full opportunity to entrench myself and to give all my time and effort to one particular campus. And once that opportunity arose at Valley College, I took full advantage of it. I decided to join the Guided Pathways. I also participated in our CAPS program. I'm signed up to for Puente Mentorship. I'm also working in Curriculum Committee, and I plan to be working with Guardian Scholars as well. So the benefit of me being a full-timer is that I'm able to dedicate all my time and energy to one particular campus instead of just spreading myself all around in different locations. So the detriment for the other campuses was that I was no longer there, but the benefit for Valley, I feel, is my willingness to work not only for myself, but ultimately for the campus, for the students. Like I tell students, they want to, of class, I work for you, you don't work for me. When you understand these particular dynamics, you will know that I will try to do whatever I can to help you become successful. And I also share with them that I'm a multi-millionaire. And they're like, what? Their eyes open up. And I go, yeah. And by the end of my lifetime, I'm going to become a billionaire. And they look at me like a crazy man. I go, yes, because every which one of you that graduates and becomes successful in whatever profession or career you want to seek, your income is my income. Not that I'm going to charge you, but ultimately, I see your income as my income in regards to me helping you become or achieve your personal goals.
Well, you know, I have a lot of students who want to do what your job is right now, you know, to represent their community. What do you think is sort of the keys to being able to become a full-time professor in your field? Because there's not a lot of jobs, and there are a lot of people who really want this opportunity.
Well, first of all, I teach Chicano studies, and I would always tell students to major in Chicano studies. Even if you're not a Brown student, you could take Chicano studies as a minor and learn about the richness of the Mexican-American and Chicano-Latino communities. And that'll be beneficial to you because you could get this particular degree, whether it be an AA, whether it be a BA or an MA, and apply it to whatever field you would want to work in. Whether if you want to become a politician, there was the mayor of Baldwin Park, began in Chicano studies, became a police officer, decided to become something much more, and became the mayor of Baldwin Park. I think he's been elected or reelected like 10 or 11 times, but his major was Chicano studies. So you could become a politician if you wanted to go that route. You could become a police officer. You could work in the healthcare industry as well, taking care of the Chicano needs, the Mexican-American needs for health. So getting a Chicano studies degree doesn't just kind of entrap you in becoming only an instructor. There's many things you could become. Whether if you want to become a community organizer, you could do that as well. There's many opportunities for employment. So when you look to a particular field or career, always do something that you find interesting, that obviously look at the job market to make sure that it's very applicable in regards to getting an employment. But most importantly, you need to understand that whatever career you choose is something that you want to do, not that someone is forcing upon you, but something that you will love to wake up every morning to go to work, regardless if you feel sick or not. You will still do whatever you can to fulfill your dream in whatever particular employment. But for those that would want to be employed in Chicano studies, I would tell them to do so. Just like an instructor told me a long time ago at Pasadena Community College, he's still there. I'm not going to say his name, but he told me not to major in Chicano studies. He told me, quote unquote, don't major in that field because you're never going to get a job. That's what he said. So when I ended up teaching at Pasadena Community College, he was the first person I want to go visit in his office. And I told him, look, I'm here teaching Chicano studies. Thanks for the lack of advice in regards to telling me not to major in Chicano studies. So I always share that story with students as well, because I tell them, look, some people are not going to like your particular major or field of study. It's okay. Don't worry about what other people think. Even sometimes your own family, your own friends, your own community might frown upon you going to school. But at the end of the day, do what you think is best for you. And then don't worry, all the people that we call the haters would come about and say, oh, I knew you could do it. I knew you were going to be successful. They always do that. And I share that with my students, because I tell them that when you go to school and you're trying to fight the good fight, and having a brighter future, not everybody likes that, because some people become complacent and they don't want you to be successful, because you will remind them often that they have the same opportunities, but they chose maybe not to go that particular route. I always tell them, look, you know what the beauty about going to school is? That, I mean, obviously people are going to get mad that you go to school, whatever. It might even end up your personal relationship with your friends or whatnot. But when you go to school, you're able to learn about different things. I tell them, man, I took advantage. I started to take an art class. I took ceramics. I love ceramics. I took a workout class. If some of you like fitness classes, you could take fitness classes. I tell them, don't just take your regular educational courses that you need to get your GE. Take a fun class every session. Even though it's not part of your program, take a fun class. If your program is nursing, fine. But if you like doing ceramics, take the ceramic class as well. That way you create an opportunity for yourself to not only decompress, but to see the benefits of going to school, not just something rigorous where you have to learn about A and respond about B or whatever, whatnot. You become much more basically in tune with your environment by going to school and participating in particular activities that they also have on campus.
Wow, Jose. I can't thank you enough for your time today and sharing your story with us, man. Incredibly inspiring. I think all along the interview here, you've shared, you know, advice and wisdom, and I think the story that you've told us will be inspiring to many of the students and community members who have an opportunity to hear it. What would be the best way for someone to get a hold of you if they wanted more information about a Chicano Studies class, if they wanted to connect with you? Is it through your campus email or campus website? What would you recommend?
The campus email works best. I'm always online checking my email, so that'll be best. And I usually respond within 24 hours, whether you have questions on particular Chicano Studies courses, or even if you need any particular advice on what particular fields you could apply your Chicano Studies degree to and stuff like that. Even if it's not for Chicano Studies, anything that pertains to the school at Valley, I'm there to help out any particular student. It doesn't matter where you come from. It just, all that matters to me is that you're there to pursue your educational dreams, and I would be more than glad and willing to be a part of that particular journey to see you graduate.
Well, thank you so much, Jose. It's a real honor to work with you at Valley College, and you're just an exceptional addition to the college. And thank you for sharing your story, because it was really amazing.
Well, I didn't want to get there. Was, you know, I guess it was a little personal, but I think it's beneficial because usually when you talk about people's backgrounds and experiences, they all tell you that, oh yeah, my high school experience was wonderful and this and this and this and that. When I went to community college, I had wonderful grades. I was an all A student, this and that. My journey was not that. And I appreciate that I had to deal with various hardships, and these hardships helped me appreciate my educational experience and journey. And I feel that many students go through similar experiences where life isn't easy, where you have to figure out a way to maintain work, family life, and go to school, and also continue to fight the good fight and seeking further education, regardless of what other people might feel is best for you or your life. So I'm just glad to share that I was one of the ones that had some good examples that are not always shared in regards to people's personal educational experience, because they don't want to be so candid, because they might be embarrassed or ashamed of their past. I'm not embarrassed or ashamed. I'm just grateful to survive and blessed to be able to do what I love to do best, and that's teaching Chicano Studies and working with the various students at Valley College.
Wow, Jose, I can't thank you enough for your time today.
No, thank you guys.